The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Raylene D. Grishow presiding.
Good morning, everyone. We are going to call case number 4250293, People of the State of Illinois versus Stephen Christopher Pettaway. Would counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Cecilia Landor.
And counsel for the appellee, would you state your name for the record?
Yes, John Barrett for the people of the state of Illinois.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Cecilia Landor, and I represent defendant appellant Stephen Pettaway. Mr. Pettaway's waiver of counsel in this case was neither freely made nor unequivocal. And because reviewing courts should make every reasonable presumption against finding a waiver of counsel, this court should reverse the trial court's finding that Mr. Pettaway had indeed waived counsel. First, courts have to determine that a defendant truly desires to represent himself and that he has clearly and unequivocally invoked the right to self-representation. And every reasonable presumption must be taken against the validity of that waiver. So reviewing courts look at the overall context of the proceedings to ensure that the defendant truly desires to represent themselves. And part of this calculus involves a determination of whether the defendant is trying to achieve a different purpose through their self-representation. For example, in Burton, the defendant wanted access to certain records, and he told the court that he would be prepared to represent himself if his attorney could not access them for him. And that court found that the defendant had not clearly and unequivocally invoked his right to self-representation because he had only indicated a quote-unquote conditional willingness to represent himself. Similarly, there's an Eighth Circuit case called Reese versus Nix. And there, the defendant asked for new counsel. He was denied it, and he impulsively announced that he did not want counsel. And on appeal, this was found to not be a clear and unequivocal invocation of the right. In Mr. Pettaway's case, the idea of representing himself was a suggestion made by his second attorney. And only once the suggestion had been made several months into the proceeding, does the issue of Mr. Pettaway going pro se appear on the record. Mr. Pettaway and his lawyer were having a clear breakdown in communication and in the attorney-client relationship. And it's not simply about taking Mr. Pettaway's word for it. Both parties testified to their difficulties working together. Counsel suggested specifically that Mr. Pettaway go pro se, which seems quite rare for a public defender to do. He told him using an expletive that he didn't care if he won or lost. He rarely visited him. He said on the record that Mr. Pettaway was one of, if not the most difficult clients he'd ever had, and he eventually filed a motion to withdraw. Despite that, Mr. Pettaway did not want to represent himself. He felt that counsel did not want to represent him, given those facts I just shared. Mr. Pettaway specifically felt that his counsel was not going to be successful representing him at trial. He hadn't gone over relevant audio and video footage with him. He didn't give Mr. Pettaway relevant motions. He failed to explain case law to him. And Mr. Pettaway's own comments to the judge at multiple court dates, and both before and after being admonished about his waiver of counsel, showed that he felt like counsel did not want to represent him. And like anyone, Mr. Pettaway wanted to go to trial with someone who felt like they could confidently try the case. So counsel told him to just represent himself, that he didn't care if he won or not. Mr. Pettaway told the court, "It's beyond obvious that he's not for me at all." And he emphasized numerous times that he did, in fact, want counsel. He said, "I want to be represented properly. I want somebody who's going to represent me. I want proper representation. I have that right." He repeated multiple times that he wanted effective counsel. And he felt like he
But
could.
counsel,
Yes.
is there any blame here to be put on Mr. Pettaway? I thought the record showed for several times he refused to meet with both the first and the second attorney. They tried to meet with him, they tried to go over a discovery, they tried to discuss stuff with him, and he wouldn't meet with them.
Absolutely. And I think that, both attorneys, I think specifically the second attorney, described those issues that he had with Mr. Pettaway on the record. And, if Mr. Pettaway can be described as dramatic in some instances, that does not negate his right to counsel, nor that every reasonable presumption must be taken against his waiver. And, certainly there are times on the record where we can see, as you're describing, the difficulty that Mr. Pettaway had with both of his counsels. But I think What I would just emphasize is really the breakdown in the relationship between his second counsel. So it wasn't just Mr. Pettaway, I think, who, had this frustration. His second counsel, said he was too intimidated to come visit him. And while he had attempted to go over some discovery, I think the fact that he wasn't able to have a conversation where Mr. Pettaway felt heard really contributed to the breakdown in their relationship. So I think, from Mr. Carter, the second attorney's testimony on the record, it seems that this was an issue between both of them. And from counsel's motion to withdraw, we can see, he just as much did not want to represent Mr. Pettaway.
But counsel, Justice Grischow is hit upon something, and I don't think that we need necessarily not consider the relationship with the first attorney. Was it Perry? Not uncommon for criminal defendants to have issue with court-appointed attorneys because there's this sentiment oftentimes that they're a part of the system because they were appointed by the court. So what we see is Perry is really textbook goes has a bad day, to the jail, has a bad day with defendant, comes back the very next day. Okay, let's get back to work. Your client completely resistant to working with that first attorney. So the point of my inquiry is we don't have to look at this in a vacuum as to just to Carter. We know that the defendant in this case was very resistant to cooperation with counsel.
I think, Your Honor has definitely touched on something accurate where, but I think the issue that I see in this case is that Mr. Pettaway should have been given more time. So in the cases of Mayo and Baez, the defendants there expressed that they either wanted a new attorney or they wanted to go pro se. And the trial courts there did what I think they should have done here, which was to take every reasonable presumption against the validity of that waiver and say, why don't you go back? We'll give you a continuance, talk to your lawyer, see if you can mend fences a little bit. And I think that's what should have happened here, rather than Mr. Pettaway being required to represent him at trial only 6 days later.
But isn't the trial judge best placed to make these decisions? The trial judge is having interaction with the attorneys and the defendant in open court, getting a sense for the process. We hard for us to take these decisions out of the trial judge's hand. These cases aren't infinitum. They must be resolved. And for the most part, trial judges are pretty forgiving on these issues when it comes to, quite frankly, they prefer defendants have counsel.
For sure. And I think, just looking at the case law, it seems like this case was kind of an aberration and for a couple of reasons. I think the first is because of the substitution of judge. So that him going pro se happened really quickly after that substitution of judge. And I wonder if that it would have happened as quickly if the first judge had been there. And I think, second of all, it seems like in the case law, there is a lot of just about this presumption against a presumption against the finding a waiver of counsel. Because, when you look at Mayo, Baez, Rochow, Reese versus Nix, all of these, it feels like all of the trial courts kind of did what should have been done here and say, we're not going to allow you to do this just yet. We're going to either, give you some more time to meet with your attorney. Potentially appoint a third attorney, although that seems, very, unlikely in the world of public defense, or, give him some more time to review the evidence. But in terms of what the trial courts, I think they had a few different options here, or it could be limited, this case could be limited on its facts as well. I think that it seems like something different happened here than what usually happens in the trial courts. But I do think the trial court had a few different options of what to do.
Ms. Lander, I want to direct your attention to the hearing on Attorney Carter's motion to withdraw, which I believe that occurred just prior to trial, the hearing did.
Yes.
And against the backdrop of the trial court needing to determine whether or not a defendant's request to proceed without representation was clear and unequivocal, I want to review some of the transcript with you.
For
The
sure.
court indicated, I'm not inclined to grant the motion to withdraw. We're set for trial in 6 days. Let's just do the trial. And then defendant is saying, Your Honor, I want to go listen the day of trial, which would have been March 19th of 2024. He said, I wanted to go pro se without him, and I wasn't allowed to. And then there's a little more back and forth. And the court then says, Well, at this point, Mr. Pettaway, you're asking to proceed pro se. And Mr. Pettaway says, Yes, sir. There's further back and forth. The trial court then provides Rule 401A admonishments. There are additional exchanges between the court and Mr. Pettaway. And he says the court then concludes, okay, so you're insisting on representing yourself, and defendant says, yes, sir. So two very direct inquiries by the court. Do you want to proceed pro se? And the defendant very clearly responding, yes. So how is that not a clear and unequivocal request to proceed pro se?
Of course, Your Honor. So, just a couple points in response to that. First, although this was at the date of his the second intended trial, his attorney, Mr. Carter, had suggested that he go pro se all the way before the first intended date of trial. So that was on page R477. So this had clearly already been kind of percolating in his head that his attorney had suggested this, and while they were having this difficulty in communication. I think also the second point I'd like to make is that the law requires that reviewing courts look at the overall context of the proceedings to ensure that the waiver is clear and unequivocal and that the defendant truly wants to represent themselves. And I think looking at the entirety of the record here, it just simply doesn't show that, or it can't support that yes, sir, was an unequivocal request. When you look at cases where someone is they do make an unequivocal request. They've been asserting this much, much at an earlier time in the proceedings. And the fact that he was asserting this right before trial, I think, cuts against the unequivocal nature of it, according to Burton, because it's so close in time. So in Rosho, for just to get oh, sorry, a little into the case law, in Rosho, the defendant wanted to go pro se 2 weeks before trial, and the court said that was too short a time. And the fact that it was kind of made on the eve of trial at the 11th hour kind of contributed to the equivocal nature of the request. And so here I would say kind of the same thing. There's a sort of a timeliness factor. And I think also looking at the overall context of the proceedings, this yes, sir, it came right after Mr. Pettaway says, my attorney couldn't pay me to represent him, myself. And I think that kind of echoes in Reese versus Nix, this kind of knee-jerk response. I'm really frustrated. He's obviously really frustrated. And he, in between this in this dialogue or colloquy with him and the judge, he says repeatedly, I want representation. I want effective counsel. In the admonishments, he said, I'm scared to death to go to trial with this man. So we can see, even up until the admonishments and through them, he's really wavering and he's not saying I 100% want to go pro se. It really feels like he's agreeing, sort of with a gun to his head to go pro se because he doesn't feel like he has a choice. And he even says, I don't have a choice, I feel. And so I think the context shows and kind of that knee-jerk response to his frustration, that this really wasn't unambiguous, when he just says, yes, sir.
But that's pretty subjective, right? I mean, he's got competent counsel and he's got a decision to make, a couple decisions. He can ask for new counsel. He can have go to trial with this counsel. He can ask to go pro se. You're really arguing the subjective sort of fears of the defendant. He's only got a right to competent counsel.
Well, Your Honor, maybe I might disagree a little with that characterization, just because I think, his counsel was also expressing that he didn't feel like he could represent Mr. Pettaway. He was actually afraid of Mr. Pettaway, but Mr. Pettaway, hadn't really done anything to create like a credible fear in counsel. Counsel hadn't come to visit him in between, the first intended trial and their next status date. And counsel, even filed a motion to withdraw, which I think for Mr. Pettaway would signal, oh, this, person really doesn't want to represent me. They really don't feel able to represent me. And I think Mr. Pettaway did as best he could by, asserting his right to, he knew he had a right to counsel, and a right to representation. And I think just kind of to, he is an unsophisticated litigant, he is not able to assert, identify what could have or should have happened. And so I think the trial judge in this situation could have made a few different choices that I've already kind of touched on, giving him some more time, asking, the attorneys, asking them to kind of come together and see if they were able to, build a stronger connection, or giving Mr. Pettaway more time himself just to go over the evidence. Because part of the issue was that his attorney hadn't, presented some of the evidence to him, and he wasn't really given that much time to go over it over trial before trial.
But I do believe, going back to the transcript, there was dialogue between the court and Mr. Pettaway. He said, "You've had discovery for a while. You've went over it." And Mr. Pettaway agreed. And then the court says, "I don't want you to feel like you don't have a choice. You have the right to have an attorney." And then they go through all the admonishments. I mean, so I guess I disagree with you in that it was, he didn't know what he was doing. The court went through everything with him. He could have said, "Okay, I need a continuance." The court, I think, would have done it. He continued the case numerous times due to all the difficulty with both attorneys. So,
Absolutely. No, and I think just looking at page R584, this when the judge says, I can appoint a lawyer, I'm happy to keep Attorney Carter on. He's kind of offering different options. And I think, Mr. Pettaway had already felt like there was not a possibility with his relationship with Mr. Carter in kind of becoming a positive one. And so for the judge to say, I'm finding he hasn't been ineffective, you guys can work this out, I think Mr. Pettaway probably felt like, well, how, what is there to work out? He filed a motion to withdraw. And I think, to look at just the language of the court saying, if you're insisting on proceeding pro se, and how he's kind of saying, if you're insisting on proceeding pro se, or if you want to keep Attorney Carter on. And to that, then Mr. Pettaway says, no, he couldn't pay me to represent him. And then he says, yes, sir. So it feels like, I think that's kind of the, there feels like a little bit of a maybe browbeaten factor there, where he feels like he doesn't have a choice. Maybe he doesn't know what the other options are, just, because he's not a lawyer or a sophisticated litigant. But to me, kind of going back to, just earlier on that page, he says, I want an effective counsel. And I think he's attempting to assert this right. And really, it's the fact that on the same page he's saying it, he wants an effective counsel, just shows that this is not an unequivocal request. It's really very equivocal. And he's, similar to a number of the cases we cited, he, Rosho, for example, there are these kind of dueling requests. And in Rosho, that was considered, it wasn't unequivocal enough. They said, if you want to go pro se, or if you want to have a lawyer, those, like, these, you're bringing up both of these things. And the waiver of the right to counsel has to be completely unambiguous and clear. And here it just wasn't to that level that it's required, I believe.
So what was the court supposed to do? The court went through all the admonishments with the defendant. You're saying there should be something else that this court needs to do?
So I think the court did have a few different options. I think that it could have, it could have told Mr. Pettaway. I think potentially if it had been the first judge, I think the first judge was kind of was giving them some time to kind of sort out their relationship. And I think potentially, like I talked about, the second judge coming in maybe hastened some of that. But I think, the court could have said, I'm going to give you more time to talk about it. They could have potentially appointed a third lawyer, because Mr. Pettaway was saying, I do want this. His lawyer was saying, I basically don't think I can work with this man. Or he could have given Mr. Pettaway, a little bit more time to go pro se by himself, and to, have more than 6 days to just go over the evidence. I'd just like to make one last point, distinguishing Belk, the case the state uses. In Belk, the defendant retained private counsel, and this case really deals with the rule around retaining private counsel. So in that case, the defendant, it seems like he couldn't afford to maintain his private counsel, and his private counsel withdrew, and the defendant signed that withdrawal, which stated he understood he must obtain counsel within 21 days or he would be required to go pro se. So this case deals with a different rule, which is if a defendant is financially able to engage counsel, but they fail to do so within a reasonable amount of time, that failure may be treated by the court as a waiver of the right to counsel. So it's really different, a really different kind of posture than this case, where the Belk defendant was pro se actually through much of the proceedings, and had the opportunity to have a public defender appointed and rejected that. Whereas Mr. Pettaway was represented throughout the entirety of the proceedings and asserted his desire to be represented. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel for the appellee.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the court.
Yes.
The issue before this court is not whether defendant made a wise choice in representing himself. The issue is whether the trial court abused its discretion, acting arbitrarily, fancifully, or unreasonably in honoring that choice after defendant engaged in a sustained 8-month campaign to make representation by counsel impossible. The trial court went to extraordinary lengths to accommodate this defendant. It appointed new counsel when it was not required to do so. It granted multiple continuances for defendant to reconsider his options. It conducted extensive colloquies about his rights. Defendant responded to these accommodations with systemic obstruction, personal attacks, and manufactured complaints designed to create appellate issues. I just want to jump into the standard of review here and discuss that in a little more depth, because I think defendant in his brief sort of glossed over that or kind of swept the standard of review a little bit under the rug. So rather than demonstrating the trial court acted arbitrarily, defendant had cherry-picked his own self-serving statements from the record, like "I was scared to death" or "I had no choice," and focuses on those little isolated statements rather than looking at the 8 months of conduct and obstruction that occurred throughout the proceedings. And that's not how this standard of review works. The trial court observed defendant's demeanor across multiple hearings. The trial court heard directly from two experienced public defenders about his refusal to cooperate with them. Judge Clifford presided over hearings on June 14th and August 23rd, August 28th, March 19th, and May 2nd before ultimately recusing herself because defendant had made threats against her and she wanted the appearance of impropriety sort of remove that from these proceedings. So Judge Swift then conducted his own extensive inquiry on May 21st, and then June 11th before making his final determination. Defendant's conduct on May 21st at that hearing shows that he really was not interested in having counsel represent him. He didn't just complain about his attorney. He was complaining about the entire system. He was complaining about the jail being subject to unnecessary lockdowns and having his phone cut off. And then he looked Judge Swift in the eye and actually claimed that his meritless speedy trial arguments were proven in court. He was insisting that he had this viable speedy trial claim, which they had decided in court and gone over with him the fact that there were continuances that the defense counsel had to make to prepare for trial and go over discovery. So defendant refused to acknowledge that and said that his speedy trial allegations had been proven in court, which was categorically false. So both of these judges were in the best position to assess his credibility and evaluate whether his complaints were authentic or pretextual. And then, there were extensive colloquies. Judge Swift went over Illinois Supreme Court Rule 401A admonishments with him. So the question before this court isn't whether or not each of you would have reached the same conclusion, but whether a reasonable judge could have reached the conclusion made by Judge Swift. And The record here confirms the answer is unequivocally yes. Focusing on just some of the things highlighted, first of all, here by defense counsel was this the timeliness factor, the eve of trial. Reese V. Nix was mentioned here. This wasn't a knee-jerk response. We had 8 months of procedural history. We had 8 months of a defendant who was obstructing two different counsels that had been appointed to him, and who he was not willing to work with. And what we have to look at, based on this court's determination in Belk, is the conduct of the defendant in refusing to accept the counsel that was offered to him or available to him. His conduct amounted to waiver in this case. Even if we don't look at his final unequivocal response of yes, sir, when asked, if we just look at his conduct over these 8 months, that alone, based on Belk, affirms that he was not willing to work with counsel and that he was waiving his right to counsel. Again, this was not an eve of trial, knee-jerk situation. This was a situation where, defendant had made it impossible for either attorney to work with him. And why would he do that? In the reply brief, defendant argues that, that's against my interests. Why would I sabotage a relationship with counsel? Well, this was a defendant whose back was against the wall. He had staggering evidence against him. And not only that, he had there was a witness tampering that had gone on. He had called the victim in this case 2,500 times to manipulate the victim into siding with him rather than testifying for the state. And so there were determinations about that really complicated his trial. That he knew, all right, my back's against the wall here. And manufacturing procedural issues like this were really the only recourse he had. So was it a desperate set of circumstances? Yes. But defendant didn't feel he had any other choice.
Counsel, let me interject, maybe illustrate my thinking or mindset of the case at this point. Attorney Carter mentioned he was a conflict public defender.
Yes.
So this is not someone, a full-time or part-time employee. This is someone who's appointed on a case-by-case basis.
Yes.
That being said, 16 years of experience. So you heard me push back on Attorney Lander's argument, sort of the subjective feelings of the defendant. He kind of struggled, was in a trap, he felt. Yet there's the 401 admonishments. He voices a clear and unequivocal invocation of his right to represent himself. All that being said, Attorney Lander has hit on something. This defendant, whether or not he's a, he's a hard nut to crack, difficult guy, counsel is being paid to represent the defendant. And there might be a trend out there where public defenders feel that tough cases they get out of. That's a problem. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's some really important distinguishing characteristics here in this case. And this is a case where defendant was, make these aren't just accusations of, oh, th this was just a little bit of difficulty. We were frustrated. We were not able to agree on certain arguments. I mean, this was like about physical safety. This was a defendant who had these were serious problems that bore on the physical safety and well-being of the attorney. So,
Well, for sure, courts everywhere, we work around those problems with the jail staff, sheriff's office. We work through those problems. I the core of what I'm getting to is counsel's appointed, and public defenders have to earn the trust of their clients. And in this the case of Perry, That attorney went back over and over and made attempts, despite the defendant not cooperating, to win that trust. Ultimately, it was unsuccessful. But there is a feeling that it's the late hour of trial date. Counsel ran for the hills. That's the way I read it.
Well, in this case, he actually did meet with him again. And so there were two meetings. And in the second meeting, he refused to go over discovery. And then he got up and he walked out of the meeting. So there were several attempts to go over these things with defendant. And I think we also need to kind of distinguish to some of defendant's claims about what defendant claimed counsel had said and what counsel actually did say when he was addressing the court regarding these issues with defendant. The counsel never stated that, yes, I advised him to go pro se. That never came out of counsel's mouth. Not true. And he never advised that he didn't care about the case, didn't give an F about defendant. These are credibility determinations the court did not adopt that the defendant made. The only thing that counsel said was that he was willing to go over defendant's concerns. He said that he was willing to meet with defendant and go over his questions and concerns and go over discovery, and actually made an attempt to do that. So, his statement about, well, this is one of the most difficult defendants I've ever worked with, was that didn't deter him from having, attempted to go over these things and actually work with defendant in this case. Also, I think there was one other note that I had made. The fact that there was an aberration of a substitution of judge, again, this is a defendant manufactured situation where a defendant had made things so difficult for the prior judge working on the case that we had to have a new judge come in. So I think we have to look at all of the circumstances, not just his relationship with counsel, but his relationship with the prior judge, his accusations against the jail, and feeling persecuted by his treatment in the jail. I mean, absolutely every authority in this case, defendants against and extremely upset with. So that sort of frames the context of what happened here with counsel, and the manner in which defense counsel distinguished Belk. These are distinctions without a difference, because this case involves the exact situation in Belk where you have a defendant who is opposed to the idea of working with counsel, whether it be the public defender that was offered and not currently representing, or continuing to work with competent counsel. That's a distinguish without a difference. There's no difference there. Defendant had competent counsel, and his manufactured issues with counsel are exactly like the situation in Belk where counsel where the defendant was unwilling to accept the public defender that was offered to him, and continue out the trial and these delay tactics. This is a case just like Belk where you have these delay tactics over and over and over again, and there comes a point where the court needs to just make a decision. This is a defendant, through his conduct, through his statements that he can't work with counsel, that we're gonna proceed pro se here. There were thorough admonishments, and there were this is not a case where the trial court abused its discretion ultimately at the end of the day, based on this record. And if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I will tender my time back over to defense counsel.
Seeing no questions, any rebuttal, Ms. Landor?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. I'd first like to respond to the state when they say that Mr. Carter did not suggest that Mr. Pettaway should go pro se. Indeed, he did suggest that. It's on page R477 in the middle of the page. I'd also like to make a few other points. First, about Belk, Belk went the other way for a couple of reasons. One, it concerns private counsel, and it just has a completely different role because of that. Second of all, in Belk, the defendant in that case, specifically at the time of the waiver, said that he did not want the public defender. He told the jury that. And in this case, Mr. Pettaway repeatedly asserted that he wanted effective counsel. As I pointed out earlier, on the same page that he says, "Yes, sir," he says he wants an effective counsel. And the fact that the state posits or argues that Mr. Pettaway's complaints were pretextual, his attorney filed a motion to withdraw. His attorney did not come visit him. His attorney suggested that he could go pro se. His attorney said he didn't. And those are things for Mr. Carter himself, not even things for Mr. Pettaway. I also want to characterize or look at a couple of the state's focuses about Mr. Carter or about Mr. Pettaway, different things that happened in trial. This idea that Mr. Pettaway was somehow sandbagging this issue for appeal simply does not make sense. And the state admits that themselves when they say that his speedy trial issue was meritless. They admit that he is not a sophisticated legal mind. And the fact that he kept on with this speedy trial issue after having it being explained to him numerous times by several lawyers and two judges really shows that this isn't the kind of legal mastermind the state is portraying him as. The state also says that, this about this issue with the judge. And I want to, I think that that characterization or that focus on this issue with the judge is somewhat of a distraction. The judge recused herself out of an abundance of caution. The idea that Pettaway threatened the judge came from the mouth of a jailhouse informant who was working on a deal for himself. And this facts that he shared or these allegations, they weren't even taken into consideration by the sentencing judge. And it has no bearing on whether the waiver is clear or not. So Mr. Pettaway may have been, somewhat of a dramatic defendant, but that does not negate his right to effective counsel. And it does not negate the fact that he had not given a clear, unambiguous, unequivocal waiver of counsel. And the record, simply does not show that. I also wanted to touch on this the standard of review point that the state brought up. As I mentioned, Belk is easily distinguishable, and the state hasn't pointed to a case where this kind of equivocal waiver that Mr. Pettaway made is held up on appeal. And most of the cases that I've cited show the opposite, that courts, the trial court does the correct thing, and they take every reasonable presumption against the waiver of counsel. And as we've talked about a little, I think, the substitution of judge, along with other factors, made that, made it kind of hasten the timeline. So I don't, I think the standard of review issue is irrelevant, and just, kind of the cases that show that the trial court did not abuse its discretion show that the trial court said, we're not going to let you waive your counsel with these kind of equivocal responses. That's all. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any questions? Okay, thank you. The court will take this matter under advisement, and the court stands in recess.